The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 367, recorded on November 14th, 2014.
Welcome to the 368th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 201st episode of the Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes additional segments sometimes when we feel like it.
Devin is not with us because he...
Why?
He's overloaded with work this week, so he's not able to join us. He'll probably be around next week when he's less burdened.
He thinks I'm stupid and smell funny, doesn't he?
No. And the reason why we didn't have a podcast last week is that Paul went to BentCon, which took over the entire weekend.
Paul did go to BentCon, but that wasn't the sole reason. Let's be honest. Don't make it all Paul's fault.
It's just that things didn't align last week.
You know, well, okay, that's better.
I guess we needed a break from having a landmark 200th episode of the Video Game Roundtable.
Woohoo! Landmark 200th episode!
Right. So I wanted to talk about Devin's place in video game history because I realized, going over articles from GameStooge, that Devin's biggest post, you know, was one of the most popular posts of anywhere that year. Millions of hits, that sort of thing. And I forgot all about it until now. And it actually changed the game, one of the most popular games, you know, caused them to make a little reference to it. And I'm wondering if I should say it now or just wait until Devin's with us.
Tell us now.
Okay, so Devin is the one who posted the video of someone getting killed by a traffic cone in Halo 3. Because the thing about that is that you could get hit by objects and get damaged by them, but you had to have something like one hit point in order to get killed by a traffic cone, and it happened. And the thing is that it's not only that, but what's funny is that that traffic cone ricocheted twice before hitting someone and then killing them. And it was such a bizarre moment that it got millions of hits on the YouTube video. And Bungie actually added a stat for killing people with physical objects that are not weaponry or anything like that. And the icon was a little flying traffic cone. So that's where GameStooge actually made a dent in the video game industry. And that was Devin's post. So while he didn't make the video, he had sharp eyes for stuff that people might enjoy. So that's GameStooge's mark on video game history. You can thank Devin for that one.
Okay.
So when you're able to have the developers of Halo, Bungie, make reference to it in the game, that's something special.
I had not even seen this.
Yeah,
well, so thank you for telling
2008,
me.
I think. So yeah, this is years ago. But you know, everybody who plays Halo remembers the traffic cone. Anyways, what have you been playing, Paul?
I'm afraid to say that I have not yet been able to crack open my copy of either the Lego Movie game or Bayonetta. They might be going back to the store because I just don't have the time.
I actually heard good things about the Lego Movie game.
I know, so did I. That's why I picked it up.
Yeah.
But I've had them for at least 2 weeks.
No, just keep
them. And I haven't been able to open them. And,
why?
You know,
why? No, just keep them. I mean, you will find time.
Yeah, but I'll probably find time like 3 months from now when the coming and goings of other games have made these games cheaper.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, at least do the Lego game because that you can play in small chunks. You know, Lego games have always been pick up and go because they're kids' games for the most part. I mean, yes, adults play them and enjoy them, but I'm just saying, you know, they're aimed at families and those kind of games tend to have, you know, where you can play it in 15-minute chunks or 20-minute chunks.
You're assuming that I have 15 or 20-minute chunks. It's National Novel Writing Month, dude.
So how is your sequel coming? I saw you wrote a post about you had 10,000 words written.
I am, let's see, what am I doing? I am, let's look at my stats. I currently, as of yesterday's writing, I had 14,000 words, 14,200.
What are you aiming for?
The goal is to do 50,000 words by the end of the month. And I gotta say, I am behind. I'm about 6,000 words behind as of yesterday. But I've had an awfully busy week. I mean,
well, let me ask you a question. How's the digital book do in terms of sales?
It's not released yet.
Oh, I thought you. Well, didn't that company publish it for you?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd love to hear.
Way to bring up painful memories, Jonah.
Painful memories? I don't know. They're not my memories. They're your memories. But I'd love to see how people react to. You know, well, you did get reactions when you posted it online. You know, and that's
People liked it.
I mean, wide reaction. You know, when it actually gets published, and you know, a lot of people are reading it, and you can go to World of Wonder to pick it up from the young adult section.
Well, the point is, I'm about 6,000 or 7,000 words behind on the sequel.
Mm. So you're not playing anything because you're busy. I got NBA 2K15 from 2K Sports, and they sent me the review copy, and this is the first time this happened for me. They sent me a code for getting the game, you know, on the Xbox One, so it's a completely digital title for me. So this is my first time I have a full digital title on my hard drive. Well, it isn't exactly true, because I did get Psychonauts on my Xbox 360. I mean, I already had the physical copy, but I felt, you know what, I'll just get the non-physical copy because it's I don't have to pop in a disc or anything, you know. But this thing took up a huge chunk of my hard drive. And the annoying thing is it still has long load times, which is disappointing. So, you know, but at least my drive isn't active when I'm playing, so that, you know, I always have that worry about wearing out my drive or wearing out the disc. I mean, that's the one thing about digital games. You can't wear them out. And, you know, I like it, but in the My Player mode, which is basically the RPG mode of the game, I still am, you know, my character goes where I don't want him to go. And this is the game I most often say, where the hell are you going at? Because they want to have momentum. You know, if you're running in one direction, you know, you can't just stop on a dime. But they take it, you know, they take it too far, you know. It's and also they have pre-canned animation in which my guy will start running away from the ball because I did an action. And it would do things that real players would never do, no matter how bad they are, you know? So there's that frustration. But overall, I'm enjoying it. I'm going to be writing a review of it for TMR Zoo.
Okay.
So that's the one game I've been playing. And, oh, that's the other thing, is that when I get NBA 2K, whatever edition, it's the game I keep playing and playing and playing and playing because, you know, it's an RPG. So I play, and then I want to stop. But, you know, I want to get some more, you know, some more, they call it coins, but basically use it to upgrade your character. So I'm sort of locked in that mechanic, which I think is a good thing for most games if you're able to get people to do that. Oh, just one more hour mode. You know,
oh yes.
No matter how annoyed I get at the game, I'm still playing. So, that's a point in its favor. And you know, so I guess, but it's also vastly improved from last year's. In terms of you know, some of the sillier things are taken away, like pressing. You see, the thing about that game is that there's a lot of cutscenes, and I just want to get through them, so I press A. Unfortunately, when you press A on offense, it means you want to call for the ball. And in previous editions, sometimes if you called for the ball, you get penalized because you were making a bad call for pass. You know, they took that out, probably realizing that people were accidentally pressing A. So now it just says they ignored you and you don't lose any points. You know, so I like that. So there's some things that were taken out, but there's still a lot of things that annoy me, but not so much that I still keep playing, you know. Anyways, we're going to move on to game news. You can take this one first, Poral.
Alrighty. Just Cause 3 announced for PC, PS4, and Xbox One in 2015, and this comes to us from Ars Technica. Avalanche Studios has just announced Just Cause 3 via the cover of an upcoming issue of Game Informer. Aside from the PC, PS4, and Xbox One target platforms, and a vague release date of 2015, there's not much concrete information about the game yet. Game Informer mentions, quote, vastly improved parachute and grapple mechanics and an all-new wingsuit as part of the festivities. The teaser video briefly discusses the game's fictionalized Mediterranean setting and Avalanche's work on the title over 3 years in its New York studio space. Quote, it wasn't necessarily hard for anyone to guess what exactly it was we were doing here, one developer says.
Hold on, you know, I missed that part. A New York studio space? A developer based in New York?
That's fantastically unheard of for
I mean
large console games to be made out of New York.
I mean I know Game Lab is here. I don't know if Game Lab is still around, but I visited Game Lab a few times. But yeah, the reason why New York doesn't have many developers is because of the high living costs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we do is all done on computers, and computers can be plugged in anywhere. I mean, It's more likely that you'll hear of a studio opening in South Carolina than in New York.
Or, you know, or in Vancouver and Montreal, where Canada's giving the tax breaks to...
Yeah, it's a separate issue.
Yeah, but, you know, I played the first Just Cause, right? And I rented it, and I said, it's okay. But a lot of people love this game. You know, it's an open world game. And the reason why they love it is the reason why I enjoyed playing Middle Earth... is that it's a fun open world game, you know, and it's so easy to have games which take themselves too seriously, or there's no point to the open world except for the fact that you're driving around, and I'm thinking of Grand Theft Auto right now, you know, who cares, you know, there's something I like to call the screw around factor, in which you get to screw around with the NPCs and see them react to what you're doing, and that's the most fun part. The thing that people loved about Just Cause was they would do things like grapple onto a plane and sky surf with it and do some weird stuff while flying. There's that. Did you ever play Just Cause?
I did not, actually.
Okay. So there's going to be a lot of people excited over this. And the funny thing is, I didn't even know it was confirmed until I looked in my mailbox today and I had a copy of Game Informer. I was like, what? You know, it's very hard to... You know, and everybody knew that they were developing Just Cause 3. It was just a matter of them admitting it. Anyways, if you're really interested in Just Cause 3, I know it has a really huge fan base. Let us know what you think of this announcement. Move on to the next item. Nintendo Talks third-party holiday strategy. And this comes to us from A-List Daily. And no, it is not from The Daily Show. That's what I always... When I think of A-List Daily, I thought it was The Daily Show, maybe. For a while, Nintendo was struggling with its Wii U console, with third-party developers dropping support for the system and worries that it would break the company's successful streak of video game hardware. However, as of late, it's gone through a turnaround, fueled by the forthcoming Amiibo toy line and such powerhouse game releases as Super Smash Bros., due November 21st, which would be a week from now, and Mario Kart 8. Reggie Fils-Aimé, Paul's best buddy there, discussed the company's recent turnaround in profits, with the previous quarter showing an increase after so many losses. He said, "We are fortunate that on both our handheld business and our home console business, we speak to a very wide group of consumers, from children having their first gaming experience to that more active gaming demographic to their parents. It's a very wide swath. Our demographic footprint is very, very wide and very diverse, and that's a key advantage for us. You can't say that of some of our direct competitors." Okay. As for third-party support, Fils-Aimé remained bullish on the Wii U's performance. In the end, what third-party companies want is a large install base to sell their games and a wide demographic footprint that they love targeting their games to. They also want a robust connected environment so they have themselves to explore downloadable content for digital sales. For the Wii U business, year-to-date versus last year, our install base has nearly doubled. We're building that footprint for developers with a range of games from Bayonetta 2 to Mario Kart. He also didn't show much concern over the console's lack of a new Call of Duty game for the first time since its release. Said Fils-Aimé, "I would answer the question in several ways. Third parties are bringing multi-platform content to our platform. Watch Dogs from Ubisoft as an example. I would love to have a Call of Duty on our platform. I would love to have any of the big blockbuster multi-platform titles. But I have to say more specifically, I want games that provide a differentiated consumer experience. If you look at the other two competitive platforms, fundamentally, what's the difference?" Okay, before I open fire on this, well, how about you, Paul?
you know, the Wii U is in such a tricky spot. You know, it was slow to be picked up. It's a neat machine for anyone who didn't already have a Wii.
Did you notice he loves the word footprint?
I'm gonna keep my personal biases out of Reggie Fils-Aimé out of the conversation.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the problem I have. First, he says we're very wide, very diverse, and then he says,
which is not incorrect.
It is
incorrect.
Call of Duty because we don't want that kind of game. You know, here's the thing, and he says they have a wide, but no, they don't. I mean, Bayonetta 2, for one, failed miserably. I mean, it couldn't sell in Japan, where it's beloved. You know, the first one really sold well. And, you know, I'm sorry, they do not have a large demographic, which is fine, you know. I mean, if you want Call of Duty, you're not going to buy a Wii U. If you want Watch Dogs, you're not going to buy a Wii U. If you want Mass Effect 3, you're not going to want a Wii U.
But I think he's saying it from a particular perspective of, okay, so removing from the conversation the fact that the Wii U hasn't sold very well, altogether. Let's put that aside for the moment. The people who did buy a Wii U, they make up a diverse group of people.
No, I mean, they go from Mario Kart to Smash Brothers. That's not very diverse.
It really irritates me when you just dismiss what I'm saying out of hand.
I'm just saying it isn't that diverse, and
No, it really is much more diverse than you're giving it credit for.
Okay, tell me the types of gamers that are buying a Wii U. The games that they play.
Well, that comes down to what's, you know, available and what's not available for the Wii U, which is a separate part of the problem.
But there's a reason why those games aren't available. Because they did sell a Call of Duty last year for the Wii U, and it didn't even...
Yeah, but it came to the console late.
Well, Watch Dogs didn't, and that didn't sell.
So, okay, the point that he's making is that the non-uber macho shooter head boy is not who is buying the Wii U, is what he's saying. But so there are a lot of other different types of gamers out there other than that particular stereotype of a teenage boy who plays shoot 'em up games. That's why they're not on this console.
But there's also no Madden. There's no sports games from EA on the Wii U.
And that is part of the problem. He's making this statement to try and be more appealing to developers, to be like, look, if you want to do something different, come to our platform because we have a wider group. You know, we have a more diverse, we have a smaller group, but we have a more diverse group of players. Whereas your Halo boys, your Call of Duty boys, they're going to be, no, it does make sense. It makes absolute sense. If you're listening to what I'm saying.
Well, here's the thing. It's not a wider demographic. It's a different demographic. And that's perfectly fine. You know? I mean,
you're confusing size.
I'm not talking about size. I'm talking about types of games. I mean, if you want a party game, you go to the Wii U. If you want a platformer, you go to the Wii U. You know, if you want
right, and those kinds of games appeal more diversely to a larger group of people, to a less homogenized group of people. Whereas what he's saying is that if you look at the other two competing consoles, a lot of their games are the same because they are pandering mostly to a very specific demographic.
That's not
to say that I think that what he's saying is true. That's just me highlighting what it is he's saying.
The thing is that, you know what? If I were Nintendo, I would just go to the demographic that loves us and hit them hard and hit them with more games, you know, because the problem here really is that the hardcore Nintendo fanatics have to wait for the big stuff, and during that time there's no medium stuff or low stuff for them to buy. And when he talks when he talks about online presence, aside from that,
what sells really well on Nintendo consoles historically has always been Nintendo's own IPs.
That's not true, Paul. I mean, you had.
Are you done?
No, I'm just gonna say.
So what people wait for on a Nintendo platform has always been your Marios, your Zeldas, your Metroids. because if it's a cross-platform game, they're going to want it on a different platform anyway. And that's always been one of Nintendo's biggest problems. So what they need to do is really similar to what, you know, Netflix needs to do, is that is continue to diversify their original intellectual properties.
I think they need more smaller games, you know, stuff that you can make quickly that aren't,
and those,
you know,
those two opinions are not against each other.
I'm just saying, well, that's what I'm talking about. I'm just saying personally, they need more content. You know, even if it's first party, that's fine. You know, they need stuff that allows, because the thing is, you're not going to always get the Halos, you know, every 2 months. You know, I mean, there are certain franchises that are once a year, right? But Nintendo's aren't, you know, and that's fine.
Oh, absolutely. Like it'll be 3 or 4 years between a Zelda.
But you know what you could do is you could stagger them, for one thing, which I think they try to do. You know,
they do.
Mario.
But there aren't enough of them.
Yeah, I mean, what they need is to look at their library and you know, see what characters that they have that aren't Zelda, Mario, you know, and go for it. I mean, Kid Icarus was a big whiff on the DS. I mean,
Kid Icarus was a big whiff because they made it too big of a game and they made it too different from what the original IP was all about.
But I'm just saying
it was quite clearly the second installation in a series, which always has problems.
But here's
I mean, nobody liked Castlevania 2 except me. But you know, but like that's what I mean. You know, nobody's favorite Zelda game was
number 2,
Link's Adventure.
No, what I'm saying is that it seemed to me like they were just doing Kid Icarus and say, here's Kid Icarus, now stop, leave us alone, you know? But
it was just so, unacceptably different that it didn't do well. And they gave it too much of a different budget.
Why give up after one game? You know, make another Kid Icarus that'll appeal. You know, say, okay, that version failed. Let's try something new with it.
Yeah, like it's not, just because the game didn't do well doesn't mean that Pit isn't a viably bankable character. Because you know what? If you scale down the production team, if you make the game smaller, if you reuse some of those art assets for the 3DS that, you know, isn't getting an upgrade anytime soon, then
you know,
you could make the next installment much more profitable.
I mean, you know, the Metroid that came out that was developed by Team Ninja sucked. But at least they tried something new, and it was.
I don't know that I could agree that it sucked. It was much too. It was the same problem, though. It was much too different from what players were expecting.
No, I just, you know, Team Ninja didn't really grasp what Metroid was.
No, the running, jumping, climbing, trees, shooting of all of it seemed great. It was all of the other stuff that was just too outside of the box.
But the thing is that, you know, Nintendo tends to go, you know, if something doesn't work, they say, oh, well, it doesn't work. We're not going to try again. You know, that's my main problem with them. You know, it seems like you get one strike and they say, okay, we're done. We're not going
to
for another decade or so. You know,
that's fantastically unfortunate. And it's like, and you could see why, because it's like, well, if it's not making money, why are we going to do it again? And it's like, yeah, but let's take a look at
Assassin's Creed. The first Assassin's Creed didn't make much money. It didn't sell that much. But people bought Assassin's Creed 2. You know, and more people bought it because they made improvements to it, and word of mouth got around. And then people bought the first Assassin's Creed to see what that was all about after playing Assassin's Creed 2. You know, you can't build a franchise expecting to hit a home run right on the first pitch. You know, you gotta.
And that's personally, I would love to see another Boy and His Blob that was perhaps a little bit more attention to who their audience was.
That was I forgot the name of that Atari developer who did it. David Crane.
You know, the sequel had the same problem as the original. It was much too goddamn hard.
But you know what? That was in the earlier years of consoles, where it was supposed to be too goddamn hard, and kids didn't care about that because it was like work for them. So, yeah, I'll just try again.
Right, but the problem is that the sequel had an updated art style, which looked really, really cute and was absolutely adorable. But it was much too much of a disconnect for the difficulty of that game. Like, if you look at the art, it looks like a 7-year-old should be able to beat it.
You know,
I'm not a 7-year-old, and that game was damn near impossible for me.
You know, Nintendo should be a little bit more like Ubisoft, because Ubisoft will start a franchise, and if the first part of the franchise doesn't do well, they'll say, okay, let's see what didn't work, and we'll release another version of it in like a year and a half. I mean, that's, you know, Rayman is a perfectly good example of that. You know, the Rayman games don't sell a crap ton, but they get high reviews, and, you know, people buy them eventually, and they really enjoy them, even though they're Mario clones. It doesn't matter, because they are Mario clones. You know, you can't have Mario over and over and over. You have to have some.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, Hangman is also 1,000 years old. Like, you really kind of, you know, if you have a proven mechanic, you really kind of don't need to do too much to it. So it really kind of irritates me sometimes when done correctly.
And
when people say, like, oh, it's just another jumping platformer. It's like, yeah, but people like those games.
And the thing,
like, offer us 80% of what we're familiar with and a little 20% of your own special sauce,
and, you know,
and you might just create a new IP.
You know, it takes people demanding, you know, writing a letter campaign to Nintendo to even get them another Pikmin. You know, it's like people had to force them to make Pikmin, and I'm still waiting for them to see when they're going to release an actual new Star Fox game. You know,
out of hell with that. If I'm going to be writing a letter writing campaign, it's going to be so I can get Hocus Pocus 2.
A movie?
Yes. Bet said she would do it. She said so on Reddit.
That's not Nintendo. That's Disney.
Well, she said she would do it. That's the big news of the day to me.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. And this is a you item, Paul. I'm going to read it.
Me
this
item.
This is a you type of item. Dev, it's hard to develop kids.
If it's a me item, then I should be reading it.
No. Wait. Who did...
You did the last one.
Oh, that's right. This is you. Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Developers say it's tougher to develop for kids than core gamers, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. This week marks the launch of Assassin's Creed Unity, the first installment in Ubisoft's flagship open-world action franchise designed specifically for the new generation of consoles and PCs. It allows players to romp through a recreation of the French Revolution-era Paris, complete with up to 10,000 computer-controlled characters filling the streets of a living, breathing city. But for all the challenges of designing a game that fits the demands of a AAA audience, Unity director Marc Albanet said...
It sounds French.
Oh, Albanet. See, I wanted to go French with it, and then I just didn't...
It's Albanet. Remember, Ubisoft is a Frenchy company from Montreal, so...
Yes. Unity director Marc Albanet said it's not as difficult as working on less heralded fare for children. Quote, it's harder to make games for casuals than for a hardcore audience, Albanet told Games Industry Biz. When you're a developer, you need to understand casual gamers and how they work. What the casual experience made me understand is that you need to understand your players. The game you are making is not for you, it's for your players. So you need to understand your players, and then you can make a game for them. Novak applauds. One of the difficulties of making kids' games is that the game age range of the target audience is a lot narrower in terms of years, but much wider in terms of developmental growth. If you target a game for 3-year-olds to 8-year-olds, you're going to have an audience that crosses some pretty important barriers over that span, like the ability to read. Albanet may have returned to making core games with Unity, but he kept that same approach he learned from his days making games for a casual crowd. Quote, it's really the trajectory you need to have as a developer, Albanet said. For the AAA industry, it's something you need. If you don't have this loop, you'll make the game for you. I'm not saying this wouldn't be good, but it sure would. But for a smaller,
it'll sure be for a smaller audience.
It'll sure be for a smaller audience.
Okay, Paul, as a game maker, you can dive right into what he's saying here.
On the surface, I'm not really sure that he's saying anything particularly substantial or earth-shattering. But it is someone of some apparent, you know, clout saying on behalf of, you know, game designers everywhere, know who you're designing games for. That just kind of seems to me, as an industry insider, that like someone saying, hey guys, guess what, water is wet.
You know,
but you know what sometimes people forget this,
you know,
you're not necessarily making a game that you yourself would want to play. You should always, as a designer, be making a game that you are proud of, but not necessarily a game for you.
That reminds me, you know, remember back in the 90s, you had the New Kids on the Block, right? And all these teenage males and young adult males were complaining about how lame New Kids on the Block were, and you know how they couldn't stand him, and they couldn't understand, you know, who would ever listen to this music. And the response is, well, guess what? This is not for you. This is for tween girls. You know, they're nice, safe, you know, non-threatening boys, you know, in their early 20s, who are singing songs that girls, you know, girls and maybe teenage girls as well, like, you know, that it's not for you, you know. So you can't really, when you complain about it, it's sort of like complaining about the soup isn't good when you don't like soup, you know. The tricky thing about making games for kids is that when you're making, you're no longer a kid. You know, I mean, it's easier to make games for adults because you're an adult, you know, but kids have a different perspective, and you have to really go back to remember what that perspective is.
And I think that is pretty much the most interesting piece here, is that if you know, how wide you're going to develop your whatever kind of games, your console games, your iPhone apps for, you know, for a younger audience, you can't have it as massively wide as 3 to 8 year olds, because he's absolutely right. Some of your audience will be able to read in that time, and some of it won't if you actually get that kind of a number. That's why a market for development is so much smaller, because if you're lucky, you'll have their attention for a year or two, because, you know, for a preschool app, you're talking ages 3 to 5, and that's it. That's all you get, which is why it has to be a much smaller product, because your audience will age out that much faster.
Yeah. The other thing about casual is that I think that the casual gaming audience is a lot more fickle than the AAA large game audience, you know, because you know what's going to tickle the fancy of guys who are into shooters, or guys who are into sports games, or guys who are into RPGs, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, or even guys who are into Smash Brothers, you know, that sort of thing. But a casual audience, you know, getting their attention in the first place can be tricky, you know.
I think that we need to start that part of a conversation by defining, you know, what do we mean by casual? You know, is a young woman who spends $100 a month on Angry Birds and, you know, 40 hours a month on Angry Birds, is she casual, or is she a hardcore Angry Birds player?
I would say the person,
you know, examine our biases here if we're going to be fair.
Well, I mean, how does that person become a Angry Birds fanatic, though? You see, that's the thing. You know, I mean, the thing
so
about
we were all casually interested in games at some point. So, well, you know, to say where that line is of where you go from being a casual player to a hardcore player, just to me as a designer, is goddamn ridiculous.
Yeah, hardcore casual players. I mean, I've seen scores on Diner Dash that I could never possibly get. You know,
absolutely.
You know,
so but aside from that, like, what makes the expectation of quality different from someone who plays, you know, 1 hour total of games a week as opposed to someone who plays, you know, 50 hours of games per week?
Well, sorry,
and what makes anyone's money less desirable than anybody else's?
Well, I think that's my point, is that people who don't, you know, who don't have an invested interest in games and just play games because they're fun, you know, but they're not. You know, it's not like they're, you know, they look through game magazines and stuff like that. You know, just look at Candy Crush. I mean, that became a fad, you know. And I think, you know, it's, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. I just think.
Oh, good, because that makes two of us.
I just think it's harder to capture the imagination of a casual gamer than it is a hardcore gamer. I mean,
I think that's fantastically untrue.
Well, okay, let me put it this way. How did you get into your the game with the that you're playing someone who's a food truck person, right? I mean, how did you first learn about that?
I learned about that because it was just something, some other advertisement I was shown from Playdom. At the time, I believe I was playing, like a great number of people, Marvel's Avengers Alliance on Facebook. And it was like, hey, we also made this other game that you might like. And you know what? I did.
So I know you worked for the Fairy MMO for Disney.
Oh, yeah. PixieHollow.com.
Yeah. What was the age demographic for that game?
Girls ages 6 to 9.
Okay. So you have a vague, you know, because that's basically around the age range that they were talking about earlier, you know, uh-huh. And I mean, there must have been a lot going into interface, you know, for people who aren't, you know, that savvy, computer savvy. I'm not saying just younger kids.
Or, you know, like ambitious five-year-olds.
Yeah. And, you know, explaining the mechanics and explaining all that, you know, I mean, there has to be a lot of that go into that that you take for granted with adults, right? So, I mean, maybe that's
making any product for a younger audience is going to require additional thought of, ooh, will most of them know this word yet? Will most of them, you know, be able to sit down this long? Will they get distracted? And you know, it's not just for a younger audience. It's any kind of audience. If you're making an educational game, you know, how is that different from making a Candy Crush?
Yeah, but I think that's what Albanet was saying, though, that he took what he learned from having to deal with younger audience and applied it to a more mature audience. You know, there are things, you know, that you relearn, you know, working with younger audience that, you know, you remind yourself that you have to deal with, you know, like a tutorial for even for an adult audience is a skill. You know, I mean, you have to learn how to have, especially when manual is no longer around, you have to learn how to let your audience know what you can do in the game. You know, sometimes one of the worst things is you say, oh, I didn't know I could do that when you're looking at a guide, you know, and you start wondering, why didn't they tell me that in the game itself? You know, I'm just learning about it now.
Well, that's because, you know, modern expectations of games have changed fantastically. I mean, and this goes, I have a story about this. It goes back to the main reason why people, or one of the main reasons why people claim E.T. is the worst game ever made. Mm. You know, because all of the instructions were in the instruction manual and not in the game itself.
I understood what was going on. I mean, it wasn't bad because it was, you know, I think it was just bad because the mechanics were oversimplified and it was incredibly hard because the controls were bad and that sort of thing. But we're not going to get into it. Although I will say an item that I chose not to use is that those cartridges from the landfill are going for $1,500 in auctions, you know.
The fictitious lies? I'm sorry. That makes absolutely no sense to me. You can walk into any of your favorite retro gaming stores.
These have
problems. And pick up a copy of the ET cartridge for less than $5.
These do have provenance, Paul. So, you know.
Lies.
Anyways, we're going to
I don't believe it. No, it's all lies.
We're going to watch.
Oh, and so my story, by the way, because I told you that I had one, is last week there was GDC Next here in LA.
Right.
And the quote-unquote gaming museum traveling exhibition.
How is GDC Next different from GDC? Aside from...
It focuses on mobile apps and games.
Oh, okay.
So the video game archive, library, museum, whatever, this traveling exhibition of like old video gamey stuff actually had a copy of E.T. up for grabs, not for up for grabs, but to play on the Atari. Now, I haven't played this game in over 20 years, but within like 3 minutes, I sat down, remembered everything that it was trying to tell me, and then proceeded to spend 2 hours playing it until I eventually beat the game. And people are like, I don't understand how you know how to play this. I'm like, because I read the instruction manual like 20 or 30 years ago. I'm like, it's all right there. I mean, a minor adjustment and it could be re-released with a different skin and people wouldn't realize that they were playing the same game.
You know what? The only thing I remember from the manual is when E.T. – because the manual speaks in E.T.'s voice. He goes, or maybe I'll find those Reese's pieces. And the thing is, a Reese's was drawn out like that in the manual. That's the only thing I remember from the manual. So,
point being, I beat that game's ass not more than a week ago. it's not the most horrific game ever made. I could probably point out a few more examples. Yeah. It might be the most disappointing game ever made because it was tied into a fantastically popular IP at the time. But that's a different story altogether.
I think Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark game was worse on the Atari 2600. I had no idea what was going on in that game. Absolutely nothing. Not even the manual could help. I know it's supposed to be a puzzle game, but I was completely lost at the time.
Yeah, cartridges buried in the desert is a complete bullshit fabrication.
Okay, anyways, moving on to the next item, and this is a follow-up to our previous story. Intel resumes advertising with Gamma Sutra, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Intel has backtracked on its rash decision to cease advertising through industry site Gamma Sutra, resuming its marketing efforts on the site and highlighting the importance of the site audience to its community. Intel made the move to cease advertising with a major games industry site after pressure from Gamergate supporters. According to an Intel spokesman through The Telegraph, which is a UK site, "We have resumed advertising on the game developer site Gamma Sutra. As we have said in the past, it was not our intent to take a position in the current controversy surrounding the gaming community. We have a long history of support for gaming and game developer communities, and Gamma Sutra's audience is an important constituency." Okay, Paul, you can open fire because I know you want to.
I don't think that... First of all, I think all right. For any of you who don't know, those of us who actually make games for a living are completely tired of talking about Gamergate in general. Like, there and nowhere was that more apparent than amongst the not only the female participants, but all participants of GDC Next. So we're just kind of done with it.
Well, it seems that that movement is done, you know.
Yeah, like, we're over it. Like, fuck yous all, go back under your little holes and stay there.
Here's... The thing I have about this is that, you know, they say we didn't want to take a position in the current controversy surrounding, but the thing is they did it in the first place. If you didn't want to take a position, doing that under pressure from a political group is basically taking a position. Your actions spoke very loudly, and now that you got shit for doing this, now you're going to pull back. That's fine that you pulled back and you resumed advertising. I'm fine for you. But you know what? If you didn't want to do it, then why'd you do it? You know? That's
yeah, I call bullshit. I just call bullshit. I'm like, I'm done. I have about as much desire to talk about Intel as I do Gamergate.
But you know the problem with Gamergate was that what we're supposed to be focused on was a very important subject, and that is the relationship between journalism and publishers, you know? And there are examples where you start wondering what's going on. The thing I can point out to you is when GameSpot hosted the thing for the new World of Warcraft thing, and you have to wonder, wait a minute, you're introducing this, you're talking about how great it is, but you're a review site. Does this mean you're not going to review this game? And if you do, don't you see a little bit of a conflict of interest here? You know, that's the sort of thing that should have been what's called focused on. But no, this movement was actually born from a bad place. Because some guy got peeved that a developer girlfriend dumped him, you know, and then it became all this thing about women and all that, and you had the worst slime, you know, what's it called, jumping in because it was going where they liked it, and it totally derailed a very important issue. That's the issue I have with it, you know.
Look, the entire word Gamergate is just toxic.
It's so toxic.
If you want to take up a crusade about ethics in game journalism, I would suggest you start your own something somewhere else, as far away from Gamergate as possible.
I would say more watchdog, basically. You know, I mean that's a better term. I mean, crusade involves, you know, but yeah, I mean it's toxic.
Whatever. If this is a topic that you feel passionately about, I mean, I've always spoken my mind on this show, and I think that goes the same for everyone we've ever done the show with. And that is part of the fun of our podcast, is that we deliberately have these different opinions.
If you're passionate, go start a new something else, because nobody, as soon as the word Gamergate comes up, like, people's ears close.
All you have to do is use a different name, and, you know, and the thing is that it has to be politically neutral, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter if Republicans or Democrats or anything like that, you know, who are involved. It has nothing to do with, you know, the problem with Gamergate was that it got into societal stuff, you know, and it just, like I said, yeah, it's toxic, and it's unfortunate that people made it toxic, you know. Anyways, we're gonna move on to a more.
Well, you'd be surprised how quickly bashing women would do that.
Yeah, well, that's another issue, by the way, that got sidetracked by this because, you know, one of the worst things about it is that they would, whenever you, people brought that up, they would start calling people social justice warriors. And I try to figure out, is that an insult? Really? And what are you saying? You know, what are you trying to say with that statement? And, you know, we're going to get really sidetracked if we start getting...
People can be fantastically disgusting. That's my final word on it, and I'm moving on.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Paul.
Xbox One sales triple following $399 promotion. And this comes to us... $349 promotion.
Do it again from the top.
Xbox One sales triple following $349 promotion. And this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. As reported at the end of October, Microsoft made a move to gain a piece of advantage on Sony this holiday season, knocking $50 off the Xbox One and various bundles as of November 2nd. Xbox bundles with Assassin's Creed Unity and Sunset Overdrive have been available for
$349. Come on, Paul.
I swear I should get tested for dyslexia.
Yeah.
Xbox One bundles with Assassin's Creed Unity and Sunset Overdrive have been available for $349 without Kinect, which is $50 cheaper than a PlayStation 4 with no games. A Call of Duty Advanced Warfare 1TB bundle is also being sold for $450. For cost-conscious consumers, a bundle priced at $350 may be hard to refuse, and Microsoft noted today that it's already seen a big uptick in sales as a result. According to a rep, compared with previous week, Xbox One sales in the U.S. have more than tripled. Microsoft has already launched Halo, the Master Chief Collection.
Not already. Sorry.
Okay. So, okay. Let's put this one out there to the voters. Does the phrase "also recently" or "already" matter to what you're hearing? I don't think so. Going back to what I was saying. Microsoft also recently launched Halo, the Master Chief Collection, which has seen generally favorable reviews. And with the top-rated games like Sunset Overdrive bundled with the cheaper hardware, Microsoft is hoping to gain...
That's repeating what we already said. Just go to the last sentence.
Read the copy as it's written.
I know.
If Microsoft wants to catch Sony in the console race, the latter may be the better choice. See, that's why it was written that way.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is nothing new. You know, cheaper means more people are going to buy. I mean, that's...
Yeah, especially if it's been out for a year or two.
Yeah.
My problem is that none of these bundles come with a game that I want to play. So I think this...
Wait a minute. I thought you were an Assassin's Creed fan.
What possible delusion could you be suffering under if you think I'm an Assassin's Creed fan?
No, then it was a different open world game. I just remember you were a big fan of... Oh, that's right, Bioshock. You were the Bioshock. You loved Bioshock.
Yeah, I loved the original Bioshock. The second one was disappointing, and the third one wasn't worth my time. I mean, I got about as far as getting the girl out of the statue, and it's like, this is boring.
Yeah. So
this is not at all the game that I wanted to play.
I mean, the key line here is if this is just a bump, you know, if you lower the price for now, and you know, or if it'll stick. I mean, the important thing was getting the Master Chief Collection out there, because basically Halo is Microsoft's cash cow. You know, everybody who wants it is going to get the Halo collection.
I just want them to bundle this with a game that I would actually want to play.
I
don't know. So people keep telling me that I should play Titanfall. I'm like, okay, my game design colleagues, I'll do that.
I don't know. Is
but I'm not going to spend $500 for the privilege.
Is a shooter, a multiplayer-only shooter, your kind of thing?
Not really, no.
Well, then why would they say buy? That would be like...
Oh, because it was innovative and it was important and I should have played it. I mean, that... All right, so here's a little insight into the game-making community. We do recommend games to one another just for the simple purposes of, like, you know, this is a movie that you should have seen if you want to stay current and you make movies.
Well, then you just go to a friend that happens to have Titanfall and you play it for like, 30 minutes and say, oh, okay, I see why they're saying this. Now I can say tell people I played it.
No, there's different level of observation.
No, okay.
30 minutes ain't gonna cover it.
Okay, well, you know, you can play it for so long as, you know, you gain information, you realize why people are...
Yeah, do you realize how annoying it is to have somebody at your house for that many hours? I don't, not wanting to talk to you, only wanting to converse with your, like, I'd rather people lent me their game.
And I'll
bring it back in a few months.
I love being a host. I don't mind that. I get pleasure from seeing other people getting pleasure from things that I did for them.
My point is, most of the time, game designers would like to be alone when they're studying a game.
I wonder how you'd feel about Sunset Overdrive.
I don't know, but it's not. I have not heard enough about it to make me want to.
Did you ever play?
Part with $350.
Did you ever play Ratchet and Clank?
I love Ratchet and Clank. It's okay. One of the greatest games ever.
Well, one thing, it's by the same people, and also it's basically Tony Hawk meets Ratchet and Clank. You know, so that.
Oh, I am sorry. Sunset Overdrive. Duh. My synapses finally just started getting it on together.
I think that's the game I actually personally enjoy a lot.
Oh God. Okay. So I actually know people who worked on that game.
You know people? And Insomniac?
I know people who actually worked on that game, and the point is that it sounded old to me, because to me, I heard all of the great things about that game from the people who worked on it that I know, and the people who know them, like 6 to 9 months ago. So to me, it sounded like old news, and oh my God, I really hope none of them listen to this podcast, because they're gonna kick my ass.
I don't mind it, because then we'll get letters for the reader listener feedback.
Okay, so my impression of Sunset Overdrive being stale is not going to be the impression that the market has. However, I have not gotten to the point where
you have to get one.
It's right where I have to get a new $350 piece of hardware.
But you know, remember.
So my point was really more in examining the bundles that they've announced. They've announced a lot of bundles that have to do with shooting things and no Kinect.
Remember the good old days.
So my overarching point, the stupidity aside, is that like if you're gonna make a bundle. You know, hey, maybe a bundle of your hardware packed with Disney's Infinity might not have been a terrible idea.
That's true. I mean,
just saying, like, go for something different.
Yeah.
You know, make a bundle that appeals to a hardcore shooter boy. Make a bundle that appeals to, you know,
well, they did.
Slightly more casual audience.
I mean, they did one for Call of Duty. They did one for Assassin's Creed. They did one for Sunset Overdrive, you know.
Right, but now there would probably be a lot of overlap in the audience for Call of Duty, Assassin's Creed, and Sunset Overdrive.
You know what they would do? They should do? Make one.
Like, if you're going to offer multiple SKUs, how about a bundle with Curious George is Curious About Shapes and Colors? I mean, come on.
I think something more their lead would be, like, with Lego Batman 3 and...
Thank you! Like, that would be a brilliant bundle! I would jump on that like a hooker on a dollar.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item on that note. And I believe this is me. World of Warcraft.
That segment's going to require some really interesting editing, folks.
World of Warcraft hit with denial of service attack as new expansion launches. And this comes to us from Gama Sutra. With the launch of the latest World of Warcraft expansion, Warlords of Draenor, Blizzard's had a tough first day in part to a distributed denial of service attack. Michael Whipple, a World of Warcraft community manager, confirmed on the Battle.net forums that stability in-game, quote-unquote, has been less than ideal as we approach our first day of launch, as a DDoS attack resulted in increased latency. The DDoS attacks are becoming a common occurrence in video games. Just recently, the long-awaited MMO Archage. I know, but there's an E in there, so.
Right, like Archmage, Archage.
Okay, Archage was DDoS'd before it even launched, while Steam, Origin, and Battle.net were all hit with attacks earlier this year. There's not much to say about this. You know, we can't really...
Here's my comment. Stop fucking with games, because the more you do that, the more it means that people like me aren't going to get paid, which results in fewer games being released.
Yeah.
So unless you want to really just destroy an entire industry, fucking cut it out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and if people get too bored, even though there's a lot of things going on, I don't, I, I do understand it, unfortunately. You know, I do understand.
These games are made by people, people who need to feed and clothe themselves.
And these games are bought by people who want to have fun. I mean, that's
your right. Thing. Like you're not screwing with a big nameless, faceless company. You're screwing with people like me who need to support themselves financially.
And you also have people who spend good money to enjoy the game they just bought too. Right.
Right. If you ruin a game experience, who are you hurting? You're hurting your friends and neighbors. You're a dick. Cut it out.
Yeah. The reason why is because apparently, and I hadn't seen this, that it's something that's been widespread. And, you know, I hadn't noticed it because it hasn't affected anything that I play, but it's just disturbing to see right now.
It's just vandalism.
Yeah. Anyways, moving on to the next item. Go ahead, Paul.
Carbine says redundancies are, quote, part of game development. And this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Oh, Paul's probably going to have something to say about this. Let's read. In an interview with Eurogamer, Carbine's Mike Donatelli, product director, and Chad Moore, creative director, addressed the 60 jobs, that's the ballpark, that NCSoft West cut in October. Donatelli pointed out that the redundancies – oh, so they're talking about redundancies in their human resources. Okay. That redundancies were wider than just Carbine, but he nevertheless put them in the context – of how a game on the scale of WildStar is actually made. Donatelli discussed the 271-strong team Carbine had amassed just ahead of WildStar's launch as, quote, gigantic, but, quote, we had to hire up those folks to get the game solid for launch. In the studio I'm sitting at right now, we still have hundreds of people working on WildStar, and that's the honest-to-God's truth. As far as I was concerned, it laying off people sucks, but that's part of game development. Oh, I'm going to smack this guy. This whole experience of launching an MMO, especially here at Carbine, has resulted in a lot of positive changes for our studio as well, added Chad Moore, the studio's creative director. I would consider us a much stronger studio than we were the day after we launched. Some of our process for how we develop content, how we test content, are way better than they were just a few months ago.
Okay, go ahead, Paul, since you're eager to comment on this.
Laying people off is just a regular part of game development. Well, you know what? It shouldn't be, and if you're running your studio in a proper manner, it wouldn't be.
Well, I think, you know what? You do have contractors, though. I mean, there are people that you hire for a limited
amount
of time.
Right, but having a contractor and not renewing a contract is not the same as laying people off.
Yeah,
if we're gonna take the conversation over there, that's different. You fucking just fired people because you decided that you used them up and no longer had a need for them. So you know what? Fuck you. You should be starting a new game. If you find you have more people than you should be scaling back. You know what? You should have something else in the pipeline. You shouldn't just consider it a regular course of like, well, we're going to start this project in January. We're going to hire a whole bunch of people, and then we're going to lay them off in December.
You know,
that's wrong. You are using people. That's not how you retain quality talent. That's how you burn people out of the games industry.
Well, you know what? You could
asshole.
Well, it all depends on whether they said it right off the bat. You know, when they're hiring these people, they tell them right up front, listen, we're only going to be using you for 6 months. You know,
we're talking about two vastly different
things. I know. I'm just saying that information is not there. So we don't know if these people were contracted or if they were promised, you know, well, you're going to be with us for a while. You know,
layoff means you had a full-time employee that is no longer a full-time employee. They're not getting a regular paycheck. They're not getting health benefits. That's what a layoff is. All right. If you are talking about ending your relationships with contractors, those contractors were never getting health benefits. They never had a guarantee of a secure job. That is something completely different. When you're trying to defend layoffs as part of the regular course of business, fuck you. You're an asshole who doesn't know how to run a company.
Well,
you're a company that will not attract the best talent because they know how you treat your employees. And redundant jobs are our natural way of doing business. No, they're not. That's a sign that you don't know what you're doing. Oh, I'm so angry. I'm so angry. We need to move on before I say something I regret and burn my career.
Well, we're going to move on to listener feedback. The first letter is from Vaqueta. And here's the thing is that you might remember that she was the winner of our Sims contest. Now, here's the
Woo-hoo!
Thing. I did not send her the stuff that we got for the contest until like 3 weeks ago because life intervened. But on the bright side, the lateness.
Oh, because you're a jerk.
No.
Because you're a jerk.
But here's the thing. Since there were so many delays, I put more stuff into the package so that she got more stuff than
it. Oh, well, okay.
You know, so she got additional stuff, including Pez dispenser that's a licensed character, and I forgot what it was. I don't know if it was Captain America or the Incredible Hulk or something
like that. I have Thor watching me. He was a gift for my birthday.
Or maybe it was He-Man. I'm not sure. Hey, Vaqueta, write back and let us know which Pez dispenser I sent you because I completely forgot. But I did send extra stuff because of the lateness of the thing. So, you know, it may have been free, you know, and it may have been a contest winner, but I felt bad about you know, delaying it so much. You know, so I just tossed in extra stuff that I got from Comic-Con and other things, you know, so that she, you know, she got a bonus, you know. Sorry,
this is late. Yes, we get the idea.
Yeah. So anyway, she writes, I started listening to your podcast in June of this year. I think you're doing a great job. I also want to thank you guys for the items you received for winning the contest back in July. They are awesome. I especially love the Sims t-shirt. Keep up the good work. And we both know exactly what she's talking about with the t-shirt because we both got it as well because we attended the Sims 4 thing at E3.
I have one sitting around here somewhere. I don't know. I keep saving these like t-shirts and things thinking that like I need to use them in winter to caulk my windows just cuz that was something that we did like growing
bright
up.
Green, not
like,
your...
I don't live in New York anymore. I have Los Angeles winters.
Wait.
Which are what other people call summer.
Is bright green not your color?
Bright green not particularly my color.
What?
Bright green, not particularly my color.
Okay.
All right, let's roll this along. I got worse.
Okay, next. Go ahead, Paul.
From Alpha Shard, I hope you guys saw the South Park episode, Freemium Isn't Free. That's pretty much why I stopped playing all Facebook and mobile iOS app games. As for the question of the week, I actually haven't seen it, but thank you for pointing that out to me, that my entire livelihood has been mocked on South Park. I find that very gratifying. As for the question of the week, I started when Dan joined your podcast and have enjoyed it thus far. Welcome to Devon, and I look forward to more episodes from you three.
So do we. So, anyway, the question of the week is a simple question. It's one I thought of. Is when did you start first buying games digitally? You know, and I don't mean demos, and I don't mean, you know, freemium stuff. I mean when you actually plunked down money for a game. You know, that was...
I think the closest that I might have... I hate doing that, and I don't really care for it at all. I think the closest that I may have come would be SimCity expansions.
Oh, okay.
But I still bought a physical copy of the original SimCity. And then the latest one, I mean, not right. from Margo. But like the City of Tomorrow expansion and any other expansion... I haven't played that game in so long. But yeah, so that was the one that was probably my closest answer, aside from all my iOS games or Facebook games, which are all digital anyway. But I don't know, I just kind of just put them in a different class.
This one's easy for me. It was Half-Life 2 on Steam. And the thing is that I pre-ordered, and this was at a time when Steam was being viewed like as the devil. You know, like, oh, who wants to have a game that, you know, this is all Valve's plot, you know, and, well, you know, and all that stuff. And I said, no, I paid for the biggest package, too. I paid for the $125 package, which gave me every single Half-Life game ever made, you know. And
well,
also,
pin a rose on your nose.
What?
Every Half-Life game ever made, pin a rose on your nose.
Well, I'm, you know, I just wanted it, you know. And, you know... And that I was one of the first people to do Steam from that standpoint, you know? And so that was the first one. We'd like to hear what your first digital purchase was of a full game. Anyway, look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with the industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy feedback, so leave us a comment at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast or the forums at GamingPodcast.net/forum or send your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net and subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments. So I'm going to try and see if I can't do another contest. See if I can't find a game that people would love to play.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, we will see you next week, hopefully with Devin in tow.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Anyways, we'll see you next week.
Bye, Bonds.